Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Ivan Doroshuk of the Canadian band Men Without Hats. Men Without Hats are perhaps best known for the hits The Safety Dance, which was initially released in 1982, and 1987's Pop Goes the World. Although the group broke up in the 1990s, they reformed in 2010 and have continued to tour and record since then. Their latest album, On the Moon, came out this fall and features the song I Love the 80s, in addition to a cover of John Lennon's Jealous Guy. The record demonstrates that Men Without Hats' sound remains intact and is as vital as ever. Doroshuk recently discussed this new music, as well as his appreciation for French language and culture, and the close ties he formed with members of the legendary heavy metal band Voivod. That's Ivan Doroshuk of Men Without Hats on Into Music, coming up now. You know, tell me a little bit, if you can, about where this collection of songs kind of started.
It started with a collaboration with Brian Howes, who's a Canadian producer, sort of Grammy-nominated Canadian producer who lives on the island here too. And we got together and did some co-writes together, and I had a few other songs already in the works. And so it was just sort of organically fell together. It wasn't anything that we really set out planned. Our last record was about 3-4 years ago. So I guess it was time. Everything just came together. And we led off with I Love the 80s, which seemed to be kind of fitting, sort of anthem for that generation, you know. So that's how it all began.
I was curious about this song because, I mean, is that something that you see kind of with the fan base? Is that where the largest demographic is for Men Without Hats?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's there. But, you know, we've been playing, you know, like I said, for about the last 15 years now. And we see our original fans. They bring their kids, sometimes even their grandkids. So we're blessed to have been able to cross the generations. It's, you know, we're lucky to have, you know, a couple of our songs embed themselves in popular culture. And thanks to shows like The Simpsons and a show like Glee, you know, brought our music to a whole new generation of listeners. And we're sort of fortunate that there seems to be a resurgence in love for everything 80s. And you can hear it in pop music today. You can hear it in contemporary pop music. You hear the big 80s drum sounds. You hear a lot of synthesizers, the robot voices. And there's a lot of bands out there now, new bands that are sort of emulating that sound. So it made it that much easier for us to sort of keep out there and keep playing live and touring. It's been great.
I very much want to stay in the present, but I have to tell you, I went to an awards event on Saturday, and they had people sort of, you know, directing you like where you were supposed to go to the entrance. And so they were dressed as like parking cones, and they were doing this dance routine to The Safety Dance. And it was like, it's so, you know, as you mentioned, it's so embedded in the culture. Everybody knows that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, one of the reasons why is I think, you know, it was a bit due to the video too. You know, the video, I think when the video for Safety Dance came out, a lot of people were expecting a new wave John Travolta to be teaching them how to do this safety dance. And when they saw this Pied Piper prancing around the English countryside with Morris dancers and dwarves and crazy women, you know, kind of threw people for a loop. And that's it. There was no dance really, except for the S movement of the arms, which is pretty, I think pretty much everybody can do that one. And there was no dress code either. And the fact that I had long hair, hippie long hair, I it it allowed us to reach right across the, you know, the spectrum of music listeners. So that we have fans now that are heavy metal people, you know, like the safety that like our music, and jazz people and pop people and punk rock people. And, you know, it's not particular to one kind of thing. You can kind of look back now and at the 80s and look at the video sometimes and chuckle at the hairstyles and the clothes and the whatnot and the neon colors. But it's not the case with the safety dance. You know, it's kind of like watching a Western. You can't really pinpoint the when it was made, you know. So it's given us lasting power, that's for sure.
You know, you mentioned the opening tune, I Love the 80s. And I also wanted to kind of talk about the decision to close this with the cover of Jealous Guy, which is a song that I absolutely love and have, you know... It's a very emotional song to me for a lot of different reasons. And I wondered if that was one that was like, beyond liking the song, you had some sort of connection to it.
Well, I share a birthday with John Lennon. I was born on the 9th of October. And, you know, like a lot of people in my generation, I still remember where I was when he left us. And it's, you know, the Beatles were, you know, still are the template for my songwriting. You know, I grew up in the 60s listening to their music. Got introduced to the Beatles through my babysitter would come over with her little turntable and play Beatles records and read 16 magazine. So that was my introduction to that, you know, to the whole thing. There's one other thing that's really curious. There's John penned a couple of books, and one of them's called In His Own Right. And there's a phrase in there just in the middle of the whole thing that says, "We must strive the Ivan while it is hat." So that kind of stuck with me too. And I just, you know, I really, you know, I really think he was a great guy. And just to think back now how young he was when the whole thing happened. So it's I've always had him close to my heart.
Was a Spaniard in the Works? That was another.
That was one of them. Yeah, there's two books. I have first edition of both books.
Oh, amazing, amazing! I heard somebody recently, like, kind of a established musician, and they said, you know, he said, okay, all you got to do is learn all the Beatles songs, and all the Everly Brothers songs, and then you're good for, you know, songwriting.
Yeah. You know, I'd add the Rolling Stones in there too, because those guys are, you know, we do a Rolling Stones cover in our live set, and I sort of preface it, introduce it to the crowd by saying these guys, you know, they're still out there doing it, and they're one of the reasons we can still be out here doing it too. You know, it's like they're the greatest rock and roll band in the world, bar none. They still write great songs. You know, it's just like it's just Keith Richards just. He's still got it, you know, at 80 years old. So it's great for people like us. I mean, I always, you know, when you're a young musician, you never really think about, you know, how long it's going to last, or it's, you know, because sometimes, you know, sometimes I've referred to being in a band like being in professional sports. You know, you tour around the country, you're competing against other bands, you're competing for chart positions and press and fans and venues, you know, so it's kind of like professional sports, but they have a definite shelf life. Whereas, you know, it's good to see that rock musicians, the you know, best before date is getting older and older. It's great.
I know. I just recently saw Boz Scaggs, 81.
Sounds as no, it's great. I just saw a clip of Roger Daltrey, like from, you know, a couple of weeks ago, just belting out the high note and the scream and Won't Get Fooled Again, you know, at 81, you know, so it's pretty amazing. I mean, I saw the Quadrophenia tour with the original Lynyrd Skynyrd opening up for them. And like he was 29 back then. And he was like, I still think he was, Roger Daltrey is the greatest front man I've ever seen. I mean, just what he did with that mic was worth the price of the ticket alone. So, you know, the fact that he's still out there doing it too is just pretty amazing.
Well, that's right. That's that longevity thing. And, You know, I was curious when you kind of, what has it been now? Has it been like 15 years since you sort of reactivated the band?
So when
that happens, right, there's never a guarantee, even from year to year, that there's going to be audience there, right?
No.
So you had this hiatus and you come back in 2010. Was there kind of like, you know, like when you sit too long in the car and your joints are kind of like, was there that kind of like coming back to life, or was the audience there right away?
They were there. You know, that's what kept us, you know, energized us, really. I didn't know what to expect myself. I was ready to go. I had been a stay-at-home dad for the last, 10 years before that. And so I was just waiting until my son could open the door, get in the house by himself, and then, to hit the road again. And so I was ready, but I didn't know. I didn't know who would be there to see me. And I was very pleasantly surprised, to say the least. It was great. They were there, and they were, just as excited as they were the first time around, too. They were just there. We just got back from Cancun from playing an 80s in the Sand festival with Holly Johnson and Howard Jones and a whole bunch of people, and there too. I mean, the crowd, the people were just fantastic. They're just dressing up and, partying and dancing, and it's great.
And was it always a case where you thought, okay, when this happens and we start up again, there's got to be new music? Because there are lots of people where it's just like, they just stick with the back catalog. That's good enough. Nobody buys records, therefore we don't make records, that kind of thing.
In 2000, we put the band back on the road in 2010. And in 2012, it's just the fact of being out there again and being in a band again kind of got my creative juices flowing. So I started, I wrote a whole bunch of songs, and the team said, let's just make a record. Let's just see what happens. And so we made a record, and it got, it was well received. The people liked it. And then I sort of slacked off or whatever for a while. I just focused on touring and not on writing anymore. And it was the fans that were kept asking for new music. It was, I kept getting letters and emails and comments, on social media, just saying, Hey, when's the next record coming out? When's the next record coming out? And that's what sort of gave us the impetus to record, just keep recording more music. It was actually the fans asking for it. So it was, it's great. I mean, I've learned over the years to give as a young musician, you never want to play the old catalog. You want to play the new stuff. I remember being, back in the 80s and wanting to jump into the crowd and pummel the people that were yelling for like Safety Dance and Living in China and all the stuff off Rhythm of Youth. I just couldn't understand. What do you want to hear that stuff for? It's old. Listen to this stuff. It's you've never heard it before. And so I just couldn't understand, but I've sort of gotten wiser and realized that, people like what they like. They're coming to see you for a certain reason. They're not coming to hear something they haven't never heard before. They want to hear the songs that bring back the memories that you gave them in the 80s and that you gave them, with the old records that they have that they listen to all the time. They don't, they'll wait till the new stuff gets recorded and gets a few years old and see if they like it or not to want to hear it. So I've learned that over the years. So that's our shows now are basically a greatest hits package with a few of the latest songs thrown in, obviously, but it mostly concentrates on our 80s catalog.
So as a writer today, how do you feel like you've improved over the years or you've changed over the years? What's different about now than say, even 20 years ago?
Well, as a young writer, you think that everything you write is destined for greatness, and you can't understand why people aren't just lining up to throw money at you. And so I've learned that too. I've learned that there's good songs and there's less good songs. That's one thing that I've learned, that not every song is destined to be a hit. And there's, I've never seen an album that has like 10 singles on it, except for Michael Jackson. But they're very rare are the records that have, more than two or maybe three songs that are that will stand the test of time. So that's one thing that I've learned. I don't try to make, I mean, the songs that are the hits, they're obvious. That's like when we wrote Pop Goes the when I wrote Pop Goes the World, I hate to say it, but I kind of knew it was going to be a hit. I knew I had a hit before we released it, and so that's kind of how it is now. You kind of know which ones are going to be the big songs, the ones that people want to hear, and the other ones are just songs that different songs for different purposes. Some songs are to go to sleep by.
You also kept this record at seven songs, which is, I think, also very wise. I think back to the 90s and CD-itis, where it's like, here's another 40 minutes of music that you didn't want,
Well, some people have said, "Hey, how come only seven songs?" I go, "Hey, man, Mike Oldfield, Tubular Bells only had two songs." So it all depends. It's like, I mean, back in the days when I listened to music, I mean, it was commonplace for bands to have, like four songs on one side and then a big long song on the second side. Genesis, Supper Is Ready, and stuff like that. That's where I come from, anyway. So.
Tell me about putting a French language tune on here.
Well, I grew up in Montreal. I grew up in French. I was born on the campus of the University of Illinois. My dad was getting his master's and his PhD there, but shortly after I was born, we moved to Montreal. He got a job at the University of Montreal. So he said they sent me to French school. I went to French kindergarten even, I even studied law. I did my first year of law in the south of France, and before starting the band. My first wife was from France, so French is a big part of me. It's like I even sent my son to a French school for the first 6 years of his schooling, just so he could understand me better. Just so he could know who I am. But growing up in Montreal was an interesting place to grow up. It's a slice of Europe in the middle of North America, and like all the signage is in French. That everybody speaks French, so that's how I grew up. So it just it's sort of not, it's natural for me. It's something we've always kind of done. Even in Safety Dance, there's French words, danser, and which a lot of people misinterpreted as and sing, until I did a little TikTok video a while ago and explained it, and it went viral. But yeah, it's just reflects who we are, who I am, and being a Canadian, true Canadians are bilingual, so that's I'm a true Canadian.
What was that like to come out of not only like to break the American market coming out of Canada, but also not to be from Toronto?
Well, that's it. Montreal, I mean, Canada's has given a lot of people a lot of music to the world. We've contributed a lot. Céline Dion, Bryan Adams, even today, like The Weeknd is a big band. But yeah, the fact not coming from Toronto was sort of it, well, it was actually beneficial to us because we didn't tour Canada. We toured the United States before we toured the rest of Canada, even. Like we were touring up and down the eastern, coast of the United States. Like we played New York before we played Toronto. And Montreal is, I often re refer to Montreal as the Little Apple, because there's a big New York Montreal connection. There was during the disco years. There was a big, huge connection, like, between Montreal and New York. And there's as a teenager, we would travel down there. We'd take the train a lot down to New York City and go see shows and stuff like that. And so, not being from Toronto, it also gave us a lot of freedom in the type of music that we did, because there was no record industry in Montreal. Though the whole Canadian music industry is in Toronto. So when you're a band in Montreal, a new band, you know that there's not going to be a guy in a suit with a big cigar at the back of the room with a wad of cash, you know, preparing to give you a contract. You know he's not there. He's in Toronto. So you don't have to conform. You don't have to be like all the other Canadian bands. You know, you don't have to be like Martha and the Muffins or, you know, whoever else came out of Toronto. You know, you don't have to be like that. You can do what you want because there was a real freedom in the creative process because there was no need to conform. You knew that there was no, you know, the chances of having a Canadian record label there to sign you was close to nil. So you kind of, and it made for a lot of interesting music. I mean, Montreal was also the place where, as a Canadian musician, I think on your CV, it had to say spent a couple of years in Montreal, you know, for you to be taken seriously. And that's another thing. It was like New York too. Like the English music scene in Montreal was completely made up of people from outside of Montreal. There were people from all across the country who came there because, you know, things were different in Montreal. The liquor laws were a lot more lax and the rents were cheaper and the women were more beautiful. And so musicians had a good time there. And it was like New York too. Like I lived in New York for a while and I think I met two people who were native New Yorkers, you know, in the music scene. Everybody was from out of town. So that's kind of how it was in Montreal. It was a fun place to be.
I guess we see that today with like Godspeed You Black Emperor. And of course the band who you have on your t-shirt, Voivod, who I adore. I wanted to ask you about that connection that you had with Voivod.
Well, that's it. You know, Montreal is a small place and the English music scene is relatively small. I mean, most of the industry is concentrated around French music. There's a huge French music industry, but the English music scene is really small. And so everybody kind of knows everybody. Everybody plays in everybody else's band and everybody sort of, you know, participates in what's going on. And the guys from Voivod just moved into town one day and I was introduced to them and we hit it off. And Michel Away, the drummer, ended up playing on my Sideways record and touring with us for that record. And we've been friends ever since. I was great friends with Piggy too. We all liked the same kind of music. You know, we all grew up on Van der Graaf Generator, Hawkwind, bands like that. And so it was just a friendship that's lasted too. It's great.
You've been listening to a conversation with Ivan Doroshuk of Men Without Hats. The band's brand new LP, On the Moon, is out now. You can learn more about Men Without Hats, including seeing upcoming tour dates, via their official website, safetydance.com, and many of those dates run well into 2026. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. This is also an excellent time to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.